As we continue our study from the book of Ezra this morning, last week we, in our study of chapter 4, well, throughout Ezra chapter 4, we saw some more of the ways in which the devil was trying to stop God's people from doing the work that he had given them to do at this time. And the major work that he had given them to do was to build the temple as the original temple, the one that Solomon had built, was destroyed by the Babylonians. And then the children of Israel were the remnant of all that was left of them, the ones in whom God saw good. He preserved them in captivity in Babylon. And so after their 70 years in captivity, he returned them to the land of Israel, led by Zerubbabel and Joshua, who was the high priest. They laid the foundation of that temple in chapter 3. We noted there that the devil was trying to discourage them in their work by trying to have them to despise the day of small things, as it was that term that was used for it in Zechariah the prophet, and we also read about that in Haggai, those two prophets being with the people of Israel during this time. But the second temple was not anything in comparison in terms of its dimensions, its size, to that first temple. So there were some among them that had remembered that first temple and could see that difference. Some wept over that. So that was a way in which the devil was trying to discourage them from building. And the Lord, through his prophets, told them to continue to build, to do that work. He was going to bring a glory to this second temple that exceeded any glory he brought to the first. And we could see there in Haggai chapter 2 that there was prophecy there that ultimately was fulfilled when God sent his son, who taught at that temple and did many miracles there. Things that they could not foresee that God was going to do with this work, he encouraged them to continue to do that work and not to look at and have their judgment that it was something small or insignificant that they were doing. It was God was giving them this work, and they needed to continue in it and with all their heart. And good lesson for us there. And he also got the people to be concerned with their own situations and building their own houses and taking care of their own needs at the expense of doing the Lord's work. And that was something else that we saw in Haggai chapter 1, where he rebuked them as they were neglecting God's work to build their own houses and things. And so, yes, they had responsibilities for their own families, but not at the expense of the Lord's work. Those were some of the ways in which the devil at the very beginning tried to get them to not do God's work. Well, those methods the devil was using there didn't involve other people from the outside. So that's what he did in chapter 4. The devil was using their adversaries, those neighbors, the Samaritans that were there in the land, to try to hinder God's work from being done. First, with their insincere offer to help them build it. Well, if they had joined together with those who were wicked, even though they were claiming to be believers in God just like they were, they weren't, and they weren't doing his will. And if they had joined together with those wicked ones to do God's work hand in hand with those who were not God's children. How many different types of spiritual children are there? there are only two. They're either God's we're either God's children or we're children of the devil. So can God's children join with the devil's children and do God's work? No. Examples that we looked at when some of God's servants did that or attempted to do that, did God bless those works or did God destroy the works that were done when in that way? If they had accepted the offer of assistance from these people, would God have blessed the work of building the temple, or would that, or would he have destroyed that work? And he very likely would have used those very people to do the destruction because that was their aim. They were not sincere in their offer to help. This would have been an opportunity for them to sabotage and destroy the work right there in the middle of it, which is what they were attempting to do. When their offer was rejected, as Zerubbabel and Joshua and these people had enough wisdom to see that that was not the right thing to do, to join with these people, and they told them so. So then after that, what did they do? Well, then these people now begin some organized efforts to stop the work. Not yet with the threat or use of physical persecution. And we see these same types of methods in the book of Nehemiah with the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. There's a lot of parallel as the same devil was using all of his means and methods there to try to destroy that work of the Lord that he had given them to do. So we can see learn a lot from how the devil tries to hinder God's people from serving him, from what we read in Ezra with the rebuilding of the temple, and also what we read in Nehemiah with the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. He'll use methods from within and from without, whatever way he can. And we know persecution is certainly one of his common methods that he uses against all that will live godly in Christ Jesus. And God's people from the beginning have faced that particular device of the devil. But before they are trying to use physical violence or the threat of such against the people here, what means do these Samaritans use to, and actually succeed in for a time, stopping the work? Well, they wrote letters to the government, to the Persian government. The children of Israel had, in verse 3 of chapter 4, had reminded these Samaritans that they had the authority of King Cyrus, the king of Persia, and said that he had commanded them to do this work, and they were right in that. They then hired counselors against the people. In verse 5, it says they hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And that time span is very significant. It'll be under the reign of Darius that they're going to finally complete the work, resume it and complete it. But they didn't wait for Cyrus to pass from the scene. I mean, Cyrus obviously would have known what he had decreed about these people and the work that they were to do. He was the one that authorized it in fulfillment of God's prophecies, that even had called him by name that he was going to do that. Throughout the remainder of his reign, they hired counselors to frustrate their purpose. We don't have all the details of the various ways in which they did that, but here it says they're hiring these counselors. They're ones that were apparently very skillful in coming up with ways of doing things to try to to frustrate a purpose like this. And so they hired them to as their instruments to do that. So does the devil have, does he have those who are willing to do evil that have experience in that, that have abilities and or talents that he will try to turn against God's people? I mean, that is another one of his methods that he's been using for a very long time, and that's what they were doing here. Well, then when Cyrus passes from the scene, well, then his successors, do they have the same familiarity with the decree that Cyrus had made there in the beginning of after he had conquered Babylon? Cyrus reigned from 539 to 529 BC as the emperor of 539 BC is when he conquered Babylon. And so at the time that he reigned as Cyrus the Great, as he was called, as the emperor of Persia, including the empire that formerly had belonged to Babylon over that that entire kingdom. So as that emperor, he had 10 years of reign. So then after him, I mean, it's a decade plus later, his successors, do they have familiarity with what he had decreed back there when he became the emperor and sent these Israelites back to their land to rebuild the temple? Well, the answer to that would be no. And so they are in the reign of Ahasuerus. When he began his reign, it says that how they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem to them. And then going back to in Israel's history, when they had resisted the Babylonians and rebelled against them, that was the cause for which Babylon had destroyed the city of Jerusalem and the temple and carried the captives away. I mean, that's what provoked the Babylonians to do that. And of course, it was God, particularly through Jeremiah the prophet, that had forbidden them for that rebellion and told them to willingly serve the Babylonians, and that would spare the city. But they didn't listen to that. So they were punished for rebellion, and so that particular part of their history is being selectively used by these Samaritans to try to get the work stopped by the Persian government, and it succeeds as they then search through the historical records. Now, of course, the part that was false is that they're saying, "Look, here's what they did back then." 70 years ago when the Babylonians ruled, and they're going to do that now. They're going to do that they're going to cause you, the Persians, the same problem. And then you're going to lose your ability to have control over this part, this region, and most particularly, you're going to lose money, your revenue. You're not going to be able to collect the taxes because of them. They're going to hinder that. So that's the accusation that the devil's servants are bringing against these Israelites. Well, yes, there was a particular portion of their history from 70 years before that happened, but what they're doing with that event, as far as the accusation, is false. But it has its effect because the search of the records was done, and they found the record of their of that rebellion against Babylon. And back in chapter 4, verse 23, says, "Now when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shamshai the scribe and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem and to the Jews and made them to cease by force and power." That's when the search was made, and then the Persians wrote back and told them to stop the work. And that was in verse 21. He says, "Give you now commandment to cause these men to cease, and that this city be not builded until another commandment shall be given from me." So stop the work until you hear further. So they do. So by force, they now have authorization from the current Persian ruler to stop the work. And so it said, the last verse of Ezra chapter 4, verse 24 says, "Then ceased the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. So it ceased unto the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia." Now, one of the things that we noted about that was that God used this this effort to suit his purposes, as he always does. He works this for to be able to fulfill prophecies that he had made that were very specific in terms of time. One of those that we looked at involving the 70 years of captivity, that was not just for the period of time that captives would be in Babylon, but also for the desolations of Jerusalem. And this was something that Daniel the prophet prayed for, and we saw the beginning of chapter 9 of the book of Daniel when Daniel prayed for that, and it was particularly because of that promise about the desolations of Jerusalem, which would include when the city and the temple lay in ruins. And so he was praying that work would resume, and so that it would be fulfilled, because it was in 586 BC when the temple of Solomon was destroyed along with the city of Jerusalem, and it was burnt, meaning it would be 516 BC would fulfill the 70 years of the desolations of Jerusalem. And so when we get to the second year of Darius in Ezra 4:24, that would correspond to 521 BC. So this would put it within 5 years. So now, there's not time-wise for that to be fulfilled, and this work having been stopped. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, and now it's got to be done within 5 years. So Daniel, in understanding that situation, was praying very earnestly in Daniel 9 that God would fulfill that work. Now, question: could God have thwarted the efforts of those Samaritans when they were writing their letters and making their accusations? Could God have moved the current rulers of Persia to make a search at that very time of their own records, not just going back 70 years before, but going back far less than that to find Cyrus's decree? Could God have brought that about to where they saw what Cyrus had stated and that he had authorized that? I mean, that's ultimately what's going to happen now in chapter 6, when Darius commissions the search of the records and finds that that was so. And that's when, by their own laws, they can't, one of the main Persian laws was that they couldn't change their laws. And so when that decree of Cyrus was found, then that's it. They can't veto that, nullify that, or undo it. So when that is discovered by Darius, then he says that Cyrus decreed that, and it must be done. And that's, the work's going to resume, and the temple's going to be completed right on time. So could God have caused that search to have been made, and Cyrus's decree to have been found at the time when those Samaritans wrote their letter? Of course he could have. Now, if that had been done at that time, and then the discovery was made right then, and the work had not been brought to a halt and then delayed for several years, then what would have been the result of that? Then the temple would have been finished too soon. It would have then been finished before. I mean, God didn't say it was going to be 60 years or 65 years of the desolations of Jerusalem. He said 70. So if it was if there'd been no hindrance or delay in it and everything had gone smoothly, then the work would have been done too soon. So did it fit God's did it fit what God said in His own plans and what He had decreed for to grant success to those efforts of the enemies of Israel to have hindrance to the work for a time? It did. And I mean, Daniel was aware of that time frame, and this is another example of how God is doing multiple things at the same time. And I mean, He's got different plans and goals that He's all working in simultaneously to make it all come out exactly the way He wants it to be done in the time that He wants it to be done. Now, are we privy to all of those things that God has in His mind and in His plans? I mean, we don't know all of that. So when we're going through a particular trial on our faith, we don't know all the different things that God is working, and they can be many things that He's working where it involves whatever we're going through at a particular time, and also why He's doing things at a certain time, and then may. Because we may feel like we want certain things done very urgently in our minds, but God may have a reason why He's going to take longer, and we might feel like, well, He's not really hearing me, and He's not responding to my request. Well, we need to keep this in mind, that there are a lot of things that are going on that we don't know about, and God is going to accomplish His will in everything, and He's going to work it all together for our good, and He's going to do so exactly in the right time for all of His purposes to complete His and fulfill all of His will. So we have to trust Him in that. But this is an example of how He used this trial on their faith to also, at the same time, make the timing of when this work was going to be finished to be exactly right. Just to mention another example, in the New Testament, if you were to take a map of the Roman world at the time of the first century, the time in which Christ was on the earth and then was crucified and resurrected, and then the church was established, and then the gospel began to be spread. If we were to look at a map and say, "Okay, here, what would be the way? I mean, where would you go, and in what order would the gospel need to be spread to go everywhere?" Well, the Lord, I mean, it started in Jerusalem, so obviously from Jerusalem we would foresee, well, it needs to go, what's right next to Judea? Jerusalem was in Judea. Well, then there's Samaria. Okay, well, it needs to spread there. So it needs to go from Jerusalem through the rest of Judea, then it needs to involve Samaria, then it's got to go everywhere else. Well, of course, in Acts 1, Jesus said that it was going to start in Jerusalem and then spread throughout all Judea and then to Samaria and then to the uttermost parts of the earth. Well, the uttermost parts of the earth, what order does that happen in? Well, as we read about how it did happen, Paul's first missionary journey. By then, the gospel had spread up the Mediterranean coast all the way to Antioch, in the Syrian Antioch. We know also that it had spread its way to Damascus in Syria. So it had gone there, and this was among the Jews in those places, because it's in Acts 10 where the first Gentiles were converted. Well, then the gospel needs to be spread to the Gentiles. Well, that begins, and it's on Paul's first missionary journey, starting from Antioch there in Syria. He goes to Cyprus, and then goes to from Cyprus north into the area of that would be in mostly in eastern Turkey, if you're looking at a map today, where Pisidia and Lycaonia, those places were, those regions, where he went on the first missionary journey with Barnabas, and the gospel was spread there. Well, then, I mean, geographically, that makes sense step by step. Well, then what would be next after that? Well, to go immediately to, if you continue in that direction, going to west, then the next thing would you come to Asia Minor, which is exactly where Paul intended to start his second missionary journey. Makes sense, doesn't it? Except God had a different plan. And when Paul was planning to go to Ephesus, the Holy Spirit spoke and forbade him from going to Ephesus next. And that's when he got the Macedonian call. There was a man from Macedonia that appeared to him and said, help us. Well, where's Macedonia? I mean, that's skipping all the way over Asia Minor to, which is in the territory of present-day Greece. So just completely skipping over a very populated area and leaving that, not going there to preach, and then going further beyond that for the next step. I mean, geographically, that doesn't really follow, does it? But God and his plans, he needed the gospel to go to at a particular time where the hearts of the people were ready to receive it, didn't he? Does that automatically or always mean it's going to be right next door geographically? Or are there other, did God have, when God was looking at the hearts of the people in these different places, was that gonna weigh in and supersede what would be strictly according to a map? Of course, the answer is yes. And so it went to Macedonia first. Now the third journey, then they go to Asia Minor. So that's really backwards or reverse in from a certain standpoint. But who was the one that decided that? That was God. So God was weighing that based on the hearts of the people. Without God telling Paul, okay, if it were just left up to Paul, he was just going to follow the map. But God had other things to consider in those plans, didn't he? And then Paul followed the plan as God gave it to him, even though it didn't strictly fit the map, per se. I mean, there are many examples like that with what God is looking at. I mean, he's looking at the hearts of everybody, and he's doing what he's doing based on so many things with nations or kingdoms and individuals, and he's got to take account of all of it together, along with ourselves as individuals. So we need to keep that in mind and trust the Lord. He's always going to do what is best and right, and for us and everybody else. So we need to, when we're facing a trial, we have to pray to the Lord and keep our trust in Him and recognize those things. It can be hard to do so, but sometimes, but God does know what is best, and he's going to always do that. And he does that here. So he uses the delay. He's the one that granted some temporary success to their efforts to hinder God's work, and then uses that delay then to make it fit the time frame of his what he had decreed for the 70 years of the desolations of Jerusalem. So when we start chapter 5 then, we see how what comes next in this situation. So we have, in essence, contradictory decrees from the same government of Persia, don't we? We have Cyrus's decree where he authorized the Jews to go and do the work that they were doing. Now we have the same government via Cyrus's successors to stop the work that Cyrus decreed. Well, those two things don't fit. I mean, they're exactly opposite. So there are opposite things from the same government. Now, which one is right? Well, what Cyrus said was what was right by their own laws, and that's why that's going to prevail in the end. Now, from God's standpoint, he's given them a work to do to rebuild the temple. And we always have to obey the laws of the land, with one exception. What is that one exception? When do we not have to obey the laws of the land? When it conflicts with God's law. We have examples of that in the Old and in the New Testament. Old Testament examples. Book of Daniel is one of the best ones for that. What happened in Daniel chapter 3? Nebuchadnezzar made a decree at the behest of his servants. They made a giant image to Nebuchadnezzar. And they encouraged, his servants encouraged him to make a decree that when the music plays, everybody's got to fall down, bow down to Nebuchadnezzar's, that big giant image of him that they had made. Now, this was a setup, just like these letters here in Ezra chapter 4 that we were reading about. But this was a setup from the enemies of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They knew that they would only bow down to God and worship God. So they knew that if they could get Nebuchadnezzar to make a law to fall down and worship his image at any time, that they wouldn't do it, and that they would then have an opportunity to bring an accusation against them, which is exactly what they did. So the music plays, everybody bows down to his image except for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They don't do that. And so then they are turned over to Nebuchadnezzar and accused of not following that law that he made. Which, when he questioned them about it, what did they say? Oh, sorry, king. Is that what they said? Or did they say, we will not do that. We will only worship God. Which is what they said, which infuriated him to the point that he commanded his soldiers to make the fiery furnace 7 times hotter than normal, which was the punishment by that decree that was not obeyed. And in they went. He had them thrown into that fiery furnace. But the reason was because they had not obeyed a law that he made. They disobeyed that and stated that they would not obey that because God forbade, thou shalt have no other gods before me. I mean, which that was commandment number 1 of the 10, wasn't it? So they weren't going to do that. They weren't going to fall down to an image. That's commandment number 2. I mean, so they weren't going to break God's commandments in order to obey the commandments of men. They were punished for that, although God then didn't allow the punishment to prevail, did he? Well, then we also know what happened in Daniel chapter 6 when Daniel, the ones that resented him or hated him for the position he had risen to in the government. So they knew how to get Daniel in trouble. And that's when they got the king to make a law that for 30 days that nobody could make any prayer request to anyone except for the king. And they knew that Daniel prayed to God every day. So they used that as an excuse, and the punishment for disobeying that law for that 30 days was to be thrown into the den of lions. What ended up happening to him? He got thrown in there because he didn't obey that law, because it directly contradicted what God's law said. We have those examples from the book of Daniel, and God saved Daniel from that too. In the New Testament, when in Acts chapter 3, Peter and John healed the lame man in the temple, and then they were brought before the council of the Jews and the high priest in Acts 4, and they were forbidden to preach or teach anymore in the name of Jesus. What did they say about that? So here was a direct commandment from their authorities not to teach or preach in the name of Christ. Could they obey that law? No, and they told them they wouldn't. And they disobeyed it, and then it wasn't just Peter and John. In Acts 5, all the apostles were then brought into, were imprisoned and were to be brought to trial before the council for disobeying that commandment. Well, God opened the prison doors, and they got out of the prison. Where did they go? They went straight to the temple and started teaching the people. So at the very moment then when they were to haul them out of the prison to bring them before the council over the matter that they had disobeyed the commandment they had given to not teach or preach anymore in the name of Jesus, at that very moment they discover that they're no longer in the prison, and somebody comes in and tells them, informs them, what were they doing? At that very moment, they were in the act of disobeying that same commandment again. But instead of asking, well, how did they get out of the prison? Who did that? And what does that say about what we're doing here? No, they don't do that, except Gamaliel reasons with them to not put them to death, that if what they were doing was truly contrary to the will of God, God would defeat what they were doing. But if this were of God, then what would happen to all their efforts to fight against God? It would fail. And they actually listened to that, beat them, and then sent them on their way and told them not to preach, not to teach in the name of Christ anymore. They immediately go out and tells us how in the temple and from house to house. They were daily, every day they were breaking that rule, that command, that law that they were given, because it was against what God had commanded them to do. So we know that if there is ever a situation where we have a law that commands us to disobey a law of God, that we have to obey God rather than men. That's God's law. That would be the only exception. Now, we're very blessed. We have plenty of laws in our land these days, and more all the time, that legalize wicked things, where by the laws of the land, it's legal, but that doesn't make it right by God's law. But that's different from the law of the land saying that we have, that the law allows us to do things that God says we shouldn't do. That doesn't mean we have to do it, does it? Just because it's legal, it's not a commandment to do it. It just says that you can do that. It's legal to do that, even though God says don't. Well, we have to not do it because God says don't do it, whatever that is in that case. But we don't. We really don't have, to this point, thankfully, we don't have a lot of It's kind of really hard for me to think of any examples where right now we would be breaking a law of our land and doing what we're doing right now. But if and there are other countries and there are other times in which that very well happens, could happen here. We need to pray it doesn't. But if it ever came to a law forbidding what we're doing right now, would we be allowed to stop? Or would we have to choose to obey God? If God says we have, it commands us to assemble on the first day of the week, as He does. If we are forbidden from doing that, there were some places during the COVID time where that actually became an issue, didn't it? And we're glad that we never faced that where we were forbidden from coming together. But some places that happened, and had that happened here. Would we have ceased? And that did a lot of damage too in places where there were a lot of effects from that. And we know even just with all the things that happened there, sadly, there's certain people got used to no longer doing that in some places and quit, and some people didn't come back. I mean, there were even some congregations that stopped having meetings at certain times. I mean, there are congregations in Colombia that don't have the same meetings or number of meetings anymore that they used to, and really it was from all of that that went on. But we did not face it here where we were forbidden from assembling together on the first day of the week. But in some places they were. But if that were to happen, what do we do? I mean, we still have to, we have to obey God rather than men. But aside from that, the law of the land says something, we have to obey it if it's not in conflict with God's law. But God had told these people to go back and build, and they had the authority from the government to do so. Now, they've stopped the work because the same government says, now stop. But God said to build. So what should they be doing? And so in Ezra chapter 5, 1 and 2, it says, then the prophets Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even both of them, even unto them. Then rose up Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jozadak, and began to build the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. And with them were the prophets of God helping them. So they had stopped because of that pressure from the government when they said, don't do this anymore. But God said to build. So what did they need to do? They needed to build. And that would have been a big discouragement when they have a letter from the king of Persia that says, stop this work. And then they have all those neighbors around them that are then forcibly making that happen. But God is telling them, build anyway. And he uses two prophets, not just one, but two. And we've already read portions of Haggai and Zechariah in looking at this book of Ezra. But what did both prophets tell the people to do? Build. Build this temple. So did that encouragement from the Lord through his prophets at this time have any effect on them? It did. When God is telling them, build, they start building again. Even though they have been told by the government at this time to stop doing it. They've got to obey God. Now, in this situation, they actually do have, they're not really breaking the law of the land because Cyrus is the one that God had used to decree that they should do this, and then he's going to make that come to the fore and cause the government to authorize this work to be completed. Even though they have an official letter from the government that said to stop building, that was illegal according to Persia's own law, but the fact is God told them to build, and that's what they have to obey. And so even though they're going to face opposition, not just from their neighbors, but even from the government, and the devil uses all of those means, and they still, they began to build. Now we can anticipate what the response of the neighbors around them, these Samaritan people, who've succeeded now for a few years to have the work stopped. How are they going to respond when these Israelites start the work up again? In spite of those letters, the letter that came to said to stop it, yeah, they're going to react very poorly, as we can anticipate. They're going to push for the government to step in and bring this to a halt. But now this is going to fit God's timetable for this work to be done now, so it can be completed within this 5 years that it's going to need, so that what he said for the time period of the desolations of Jerusalem would be exactly the 70 years that he said, and not less and not more. So Lord willing, we'll look at some more of chapter 5 next week. Let's go to our Heavenly Father in prayer as we close.